Want to identify the date or anything?
Yeah, I'll do that. Today is July 14th, the year 2000. I'm Jeff Charnley, interviewing Dr. Theodore Kennedy for Michigan State University's Oral History Project for the Sesquicentennial, to be commemorated 5 years from now in the year 2005. Dr. Kennedy, you can see we're tape recording this session. Do you give us permission to record this interview?
Well, yes, I think so.
I'd like to start first with a little bit about your educational and professional background. Would you tell us a little bit where you grew up and where'd you go to school?
Grew up in the state of Indiana, in the western central part of the state. Educated in public schools, partially educated. Attended Wabash College, graduated in 1941. After that, I had a year of graduate study, majoring in speech, at the Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge. I decided I wanted to get out of the Midwest for a while, and that was very interesting. The University of Wisconsin gave me an assistantship, and I got my master's degree there in 1943, and then followed various things. I did a little radio announcing. I taught a year of high school senior English and coaching debate at Brookings, South Dakota. I got a graduate assistantship at the State University of Iowa, Iowa City. And after a year there, Michigan State offered me an instructorship, which I accepted and started joining the faculty here in the fall of 1945. And during the summers, mostly, I completed my residency at Wisconsin, and which took a lot of time. And I got my doctorate there in 1953.
And in what field was that?
Speech.
In speech.
Minor in American history.
And
had some great teachers at Wisconsin at that time.
Who were some of those?
My favorite was Professor Heseltine in the history department. He had a terrible voice, but he surely gave fascinating lectures. Mm-hmm.
And that's William Heseltine?
Yeah. William, the he's unfortunately not nearly as interesting a writer as he was speaker, but he was more entertaining than any movie.
Mm-hmm. And what were his courses?
History of the South.
Principle. In the South,
yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I had a good time with it.
The during World War II, did you serve?
I was working. In the summer of 1940, I was working out in California, as I tell my students, in the managerial department of a pick and shovel. And I was working on, I guess it's Yerba Buena Island in the middle of San Francisco Bay. We were clearing a fire trail across the island. I looked down, and there was a destroyer sliding through the water because of the naval station on the island. And the Congress had just passed the Selective Service Act. And for the first time, I said, by God, this war is going to affect me. And that was quite a sensation. But that fall, I had a suspicion I wouldn't qualify, so I asked him for a physical exam. So I could, if I passed, I wanted to enlist in the Navy Air Force. Mm-hmm. But I was made 4F, I had a leaky heart valve and rheumatism, so I decided I wouldn't make a very good service man. Well, I never called back. Mm-hmm.
So you were started here as an instructor first, mm-hmm. and then you completed your degree.
The Michigan State had just, the year before, created what they call the Basic College, which then consisted of 7 departments, and only one was required by all freshmen. It's called Written and Spoken English, and that's, of course, what I taught. I taught a course similar to that at the University of Iowa as a graduate assistant. And the other two departments, if I can remember them now, there was physical science and biological science. The student had a choice of those two. Had a choice of, history and civilization. Well, this is all the records, of course. Mm-hmm. And literature and fine arts. Social science. Oh, yes. And then a rare course called effective living, which wasn't much of a course. We had a transfer student from MIT, and they thought he ought to take a course in the basic college, and it was effective living. Well, he finally, at 8 o'clock class in the summer, he managed to pull himself out of bed one morning about the second week of the term. I was an MIT man in my head. And the teacher was explaining how you figure your grade point average. He never went back.
You taught written and spoken English. Okay.
About 4 or 5 years later, they changed the name to Communication Skills. Mm-hmm. With a better name for it. Mm-hmm.
When you first came to Michigan State, what do you remember about the campus? Some of those first visits.
I remember walking, I was staying at the Olds Hotel, now the office building in downtown Lansing, and took the bus out to East Lansing, which let me off out near the Collingwood entrance. I was walking across to the auditorium where the Mr. Bagwell, the department head, had his office. And I looked around as I was walking, and I thought, boy, this place has great potential. And the irony is that this spring I retired, I was walking across the same route, really, past the Natural Science Building and all, and I thought, gee, this place has great potential.
So at least one constant. How was the campus different when you first got here?
Well, about the only thing south of the river was a log cabin used mostly for parties, and Spartan Stadium, it was then Macklin Field, I guess they called it, and Jennison Fieldhouse. Oh yes, and that building, I forget what they call it, but across the street from Jennison, where they were used mostly by the ROTC.
Yeah, demonstration hall.
Yeah, and that's all that was over here. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it was just field. What was it? Where the parking ramp across from big dormitory named after the president who preceded Hannah?
Shaw.
There was a big dairy barn there for that parking ramp.
I see. Yeah. So the physical site of the campus is expanded
much greatly. Smaller, yeah. Yeah. Enrollment was a little under 6,000 students. It had been higher than 6,000, a little higher, a year or two before. But at the fall, it was just under 6,000. And I think it gained, with the end of the war in August 45, I think it gained at least 1,000 enrollment each term through the quarter system, mm-hmm. that it was. So it ended up with probably about 8,000 students or more.
How large were your classes teaching them in the introductory courses?
The idea was that the basic college courses, these were to be primarily teaching courses. And the emphasis was going to be on good teaching. And in our course, where the students had to both write and speak, the idea was to keep the enrollment down to 20 students a class. Well, they didn't do it. It was up to 22.
Enrollment
and,
creep.
Of course, the next term it was 23 or 4 and so on. And eventually, they were routinely from 28 to 30 students. Mm-hmm.
What, that basic course that you taught, mm-hmm. Did you balance between writing and the speaking, or did you emphasize?
Well,
because of your background, emphasize the speech, or?
Well, no, we most of us did both, mm-hmm. Pretty evenly. Because we had a syllabus, it didn't spell out what we were to do day by day. Mm-hmm. They tried that the first year, it didn't work with it. In fact, the first year, We had separate instructors for teaching speech, teaching writing. And they were supposed to be closely coordinated. they didn't coordinate with a darn.
I see.
So we taught both.
Looked better on paper than it did.
And the theory was students would read the assignments and then write a paper and then further refine their thoughts as into a speech. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, what most of them did when they spoke, they just gave their paper orally. Mm-hmm. So another theory didn't work out too well in practice.
Mm-hmm. Who else was involved in that in the department at that time?
There
was the chair? Bagwell, you said?
Paul Bagwell was head of the department. That was our official title as head. And they were the boss, no question about it. Bagwell was a fairly young man. He was in his low 30s when I came here. Mm-hmm. And he'd been crippled, I don't know, by polio or a football accident, I'm not sure, maybe both. Very charming fellow, delightful guy, and extremely conscientious in carrying out his instructions from on high. He was a good head of the department. He brought a lot of fine people here. There's Fred Reeve, with a PhD from Princeton, and Ralph Renwick, a PhD from Harvard, came later. Sam Baskett, PhD from California. Never had anyone from Yale. Well, let's see, I guess Henry Silverman from Yale came later. But he had good people from all over, and he also attracted a few nuts, not too many, but, you know, odd 5% maybe. And, of course, there was a lot of turnover in the department. Mm-hmm. That was one of the problems with it. It was hard work to manage. You have 75 to or 80 or more students, and they're writing a paper every 10 days or so, and you've got to schedule the speeches and all that. So it was a very demanding teaching job. Mm-hmm. And when more attractive job offers came along, as they did for most people, they'd leave. Mm-hmm.
So you had a lot of turnover those early years.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the areas about that, what difference do you see in students from early in your career to later? What were some of the differences?
First term here, I was kind of shocked at I don't want to say how poor the students were, but it was more a matter of attitude. They seemed to view it as just another year of high school. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't been used to that at the University of Iowa nor at Wisconsin, both places I taught as a graduate assistant. Wisconsin had only sophomores and upperclassmen, which makes a difference, but Iowa had freshmen. And they were serious students there, and some of them didn't seem to be here. But with the year following, 46, 47, was the most dramatic year of all the 40 I taught. That was when the veterans were discharged, and they were a special bunch, and boy, they were great. I don't know exactly what it was, when it was. I think it might have been in the fall of 1946 when there was registration. It took place in the auditorium, and there was no ramp in the auditorium. The floor was flat. I went over one afternoon and went up in the balcony on the west end, looked down, and right down below me there were five of my colleagues in my department, two tables almost side by side, at which two men were sitting there, and behind them was a third table with one person and a whole bunch of these IBM enrollment cards. And extending almost all the way across the auditorium was a double row of students waiting to get enrolled in our course, most of them still wearing their Army uniform. And all of them with what that pin, discharge pin, they call the ruptured duck. And I couldn't believe my eyes. These veterans that come out, they'd hand their schedule to one of these four men. He'd look at his schedule and find a course that this would fit this person's schedule, and he'd turn around, call the number to the person behind, he'd hand an IBM card, and that was it. And they were putting students in classes that didn't exist. They didn't have a teacher for it, they didn't have a room for it, and they just didn't come to this place on Monday morning to get your room assignment. Uh-huh. And they took care of the whole bunch. I'll tell you one way they did it. A teacher would have three classes, and he would meet those three classes each four times a week, 4 hours a week. It was 2 1-hour sessions and 1 2-hour session. The 2 hour was supposed to be a writing laboratory. Mm-hmm. Then, in addition, there was a lecture hour the students attended. And so I had my three classes. They very quickly called and said, "Would you mind taking a fourth class? We're in a terrible..." "Oh, okay, fine." And then a day or two later, "Would you mind taking still another class?" So for about a month, I had five classes. Mm-hmm. And meeting, I was 20 hours a week I was spending in the classroom. Mm-hmm. But it was, it was a crisis, and they were delighted to do what we could. And I'm sure most of the members of the faculty taught extra classes that period. After about a month, we began to get teachers who were discharged veterans. Ben Hickok was one, Ben Strandis was another, Harold Sponberg was a third, Bob Lemianski was another. And after about a month, I was down to four classes for that term. And it was Bob Wright, was another veteran that joined the faculty that about that time. Mm-hmm. So it was an interesting tour. And these students, these veterans, well, for one thing, most of them were anywhere from 20 to 25 years old, and they were mostly enlisted men. And I never discussed this with them. I had a hunch that they had seen their officers. And the only real difference they could see between themselves and the officer was the officers had been to college. Mm-hmm. With almost all my friends, not all, but almost all, who were college graduates, became officers. Mm-hmm. And even those that didn't became sergeants. So this was a great opportunity for them. The GI Bill made it free for them. They got all their expenses, including out-of-state tuition and a living allowance. And they were so eager to catch up. And they were also, having been in the military, they were so tolerant of conditions. A great many of them were sleeping in triple-decker bunks in Jenison Fieldhouse.
Hmm. It was probably an improvement over sleeping in the mud and the rain.
I was talking not to much. A doctor who did some work for me, and he told me his father had been here, and he remembered sleeping in those triple-deckers in Jenison.
In Jenison. I don't think students would stand for that today.
No, but you see, no matter how bad it was here, it was better than the Army.
Very true. Do you remember anything about how the students that were here prior to the veterans coming, mm-hmm. how did they respond to the vets coming back?
Well, I think they were overwhelmed by them. Oh. You know, they, mm-hmm. For example, there had been I remember when I was being interviewed with Mr. Bagwell, and he asked me if I'd excuse him for a half hour, and then we'd go over and meet the dean. And he told me about the Rose Garden, which then was just outside the east end of the auditorium, and I said, "Oh yeah, I'll go out and smoke a cigarette." A kind of funny look came on his face. He didn't say anything, and I wondered. Well, it turns out there was a tradition on the campus, except in the Union Building, there was no smoking on the campus north of the river, mm-hmm. and that lasted about 5 minutes after the veterans came arrived.
Many of whom were smokers.
Oh yeah, and then the class was over, they'd have a cigarette in their mouth. Mm-hmm. So that tradition went by the board. It sort of lost its effect when someone reported that in the older days they'd never, Oh, the penalty was you get thrown in the river if they caught you smoking a cigarette. No. But instead, they used to, some alumnus talked about sitting on the steps of one of the old forestry building, one of the old buildings, and they'd have, they all chewed tobacco and had spitting contests. And I think everyone agreed cigarettes were preferable to that.
Some of your own personal scholarship and research that you were interested in, what ultimately did you write your dissertation on?
I wrote a dissertation on Senator Arthur H. Vandenberg,
okay,
who had a long career in the U.S. Senate, and he was first appointed to fill a term of a very short period, and I think, as I recall, in 1928. And he promptly got elected to a full term. And he came up for re-election, my recollection is, in 1934. Well, that was the year the Democrats swept almost everything. Roosevelt's New Deal was in full swing. But he squeaked through, he got re-elected. And after 1934 or 36, I've forgotten now which one, I think 36, the Republicans only had 16 senators and something like 85 members of Congress. So he made a terrific leap in seniority, mm-hmm, because there were so few Republicans left.
He'd been there just a couple years.
And he was considered as a vice presidential nominee in 1940. But he declined it, perhaps not too tactfully, and because he was running for re-election and was pretty certain of re-election, and no one was very confident about beating Roosevelt in 1940. Mm-hmm. So 4 years later, when he might have considered the nomination for president, the boss had said, "No way." He had been a kind of a leading isolationist in the 1930s. And I remember his saying when the Lend-Lease Bill came up for vote in 1940, after the election in 1941, he said, "I consider that we are now voting yes or no on whether this country gets involved in the war, whether this country goes to war." Of course, he was dead right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the war came, and he realized that the role of this country was different. I mean, our position was different. Instead of being, all during the 1930s, during the appeasement of Hitler and all that, no one consulted Washington or FDR. They just ignored this country, mm-hmm, and didn't think very much about Russia either. It was all Britain, France, Germany, Italy, a little bit. So, as I say, Vandenberg realized the situation had changed, and so he changed his position on international cooperation. And he was the leader of the bipartisan foreign policy. He had virtually an absolute veto over any legislation having to do with foreign relations, because if he said no, all the Republicans who were much stronger than, and a good many Democrats would just turn the thumbs down on it. Mm-hmm. If he approved it, they'd generally go along with it. So, and of course, from 46 to 48, Republicans were in the majority, and he was then third in line for the presidency, because after Truman took off. Because the speaker was second in line, he was third. Mm-hmm. And so he was very influential in his role, and he was delegate to the United Nations conference. There's an interesting anecdote that I must somehow get into print. I went over to Grand Rapids and interviewed his personal physician, who was also his close friend. And he told me about how one different incident about how Vandenberg had been director of a Grand Rapids bank. And at that time, the directors were liable to assessment equal to their stock holding. And Vandenberg had $50,000 investment in that bank, and the assessment was levied, and he had to come up with $50,000 cash to save the bank. Mm-hmm. It was a great danger, it was a run. Mm-hmm. People getting scared and taking the money out. And Dr. Smith, his name was, told me that he was in a Brown study that night. And he was sitting there after an hour or two. He said, "I think I have the answer." He went to telephone call up President Hoover and said that these bank runs are caused mostly by small depositors. And if we could insure their accounts, the banks would be safe from these runs. Well, Hoover didn't really go for the idea, because this had been tried before at state levels and had worked, gone bankrupt. So it didn't get anywhere under Hoover. When Roosevelt came in, they had the Banking Act. Vandenberg convinced Senator Glass of Virginia that this is a great idea. And the irony is that Roosevelt threatened to veto the banking bill if it had this insurance featured in it. And Carter Glass said to Vandenberg, "Well, what about that?" He said, "Oh, we'll pass it over as veto." And so that's how he got federal bank deposit insurance. But the other incident I'll tell you about, it had occurred about 1948, in that era. Vandenberg was coming through Grand Rapids by spending over the night there and flying on to Washington. Dr. Smith said, I said to him, "No, listen," he said, "why don't you just let me drive you down to Detroit Airport, and I think the Willow Run probably is. And we can have a good visit on the way, or my chauffeur will take us down, and you won't lose any time." And okay, that was fine, Vandenberg. But so the car took off, and when it parked, it wasn't at Willow Run, it was at the right in front of the University of Michigan Hospital. And what's this? And Smith said, "I have everyone here all prepared to give you a complete physical examination that normally would take 2 or 3 days, they'll do it in 1 day." Mm-hmm. And Vandenberg said, "I've got to get back to Washington." He said, "They're all ready for you. Take you just 1 day." And they went him through and they saw a spot on his lung. And Dr. Smith said to him, "You ought to have an operation right away." And Vandenberg said, "I've got to get back to Washington to get this NATO treaty through. That's more important than my life." Hmm. And I said to him, I was interviewing him a whole year and a half after Vandenberg had died. I think he died in 51. I said, "Do you think if he'd had the operation then?" He said, "He'd be alive today." So, you know, there's a guy who gave his life for his job. Mm-hmm. And I always think of that when I hear, read people say cynical things about members of Congress. Mm-hmm. Those guys often give a great deal.
Did you ever meet him personally?
I did not. I had a little correspondence with him, but he was too sick at the time.
I see. Did you continue on with any after he died?
I stupidly did not. I was so fatigued when I finished it and bored with the subject by that time, that I thought, well, I'll give myself a rest. And I just never picked it up, which is a bad mistake. Yeah. I could have had 2 or 3 nice articles at least out of it. And it came in somewhat useful, because in 1956, I ought to back up just a bit and say that Mr. Bagwell, I think he began to get kind of bored with his job early in the 50s and became active in the Junior Chamber of Commerce. And and became got elected the national president of the Ginger Chamber of Commerce. Then he got interested in state politics, and he ran, I believe, in 1956. I wouldn't swear to it, as Auditor General, which was then an elective office. Mm-hmm. And he ran a good race. In fact, I think he led the ticket. But he called me in the office one day, and this had been in 56. He said, "Ted, you're a Republican, aren't you?" And I assured him I was. He said, "Well, do you know Chuck Chamberlain is running for Congress?" And I said, "Well, I've met him." He said, "Well, he needs help with his television program. Do you think you could help him?" And I said, "Well, I don't know anything about television. I work in radio, and I suppose it's similar. So I'll help him if I can." So anyway, I met the Chamberlains, and a poor guy. I met him. He and his wife were both there in the office. And they looked like, there was big dark circles under their eyes. Looked like a couple of raccoons. And I thought, gee, if I could help these people, I sure want to try. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of pitched in, wrote a couple of speeches for him,